The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America. This lecture, titled Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, is the eighth of a 16-part series from Yavna to Beitar. This lecture was originally given at Machon LaTorah, the Jewish Learning Network of Michigan, and is dedicated to the memory and the Ilui Nishmas Chaim Nochem Levi ben Yoel, Olav Shalom, Reb Nochem Tolwin of blessed memory.
If someone were to ask you, what is the most critical ingredient necessary to produce a Godel Batorah, a giant of spirit and scholarship? What would your answer be? The question by no means is an easy one. Because if you examine the lives of those giants of Jewry, the Gedolei Yisrael, especially those that we've studied last year and this present year, it's very difficult to find a common thread that unites them all. Some came from backgrounds that one would feel is conducive to produce a great person. Take the life of Rabbi Yeshua, for instance, the subject of our sixth lecture of this series. According to Rashi, while his mother was still pregnant with him, she went to the great scholars, to the Bote Midrashos, to the great yeshivas, and asked that they pray on behalf of the fetus that would grow up to be a great person. According to the Yerushalmi and Yevamos, she used to bring the crib into the place where the study took place, so somehow the child would absorb the sounds, have a positive attitude. But yet that doesn't seem to be critical. For we look in the life of Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus, for instance, whose parents gave him a very poor education. And in fact, by the time he was 28, according to the Medrash Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, he didn't know how to pray, didn't know how to daven. He didn't know how to say grace after meals. He didn't know how to bench. He didn't even know how to say Shema. And when he left to yeshiva, it was against the will of his parents. In fact, his father was ready to disown him entirely. So it seems the parental support, moral support, doesn't seem to be a critical factor. One would say, perhaps, if one comes from a family of means. After all, if a person doesn't have to worry about how to put bread on the table, one is in a greater, better frame of mind, one can concentrate better on learning. And we do find many of the Gedolei Yisrael came from homes of wealth. Rabbi Gamaliel, the subject of the last lecture, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, this week's lecture, Rabbi Tarfon, next week's lecture, the next lecture. And yet we find great people who are destitute. Hillel, Rabbi Akiva. In fact, the Gemara in Yoma says that in the day of judgment, someone, when each one of us will be asked why we didn't do more with our lives. And if an excuse is given, well, I was just too poor. The answer will be, well, were you as poor as Hillel? Hillel worked all day, took half of his earnings, took half for his family, and the other half came to pay for the entrance costs in entering the yeshiva. And that was the story you're familiar with, that the day that he made too little and he couldn't afford the entrance to the yeshiva, he went on the skyline, the skylight of the yeshiva to listen to the shiur, to listen to the lectures it was given. And he didn't realize this, but the snow was falling on him. He was so absorbed, and he was covered with snow, and he almost died. Avos Reb Nosson points to the life of Rabbi Akiva, a similar situation. And also points out in the day of judgment, if someone gives the excuse, I was just too poor to study, he says, were you poorer than Rabbi Akiva? So it doesn't seem that wealth, even though it's an advantage, doesn't seem to be a critical ingredient. Well, there's the other factor, which we discussed last week, of yichus. If one comes from a line of great scholars, in a sense, it's one's genes. The Gemara in Bava Metzia and Pehei Omed Aleph in 85a that states that after the Torah's three generations in a family, it's easier to come back. Torah Machazeres Alachsanya Shalom. The Torah comes back to its old inn, to its old home. And for many of the lives of the Gedolim, we find that they did come from a great line of scholars and people of prestige. On the other hand, we find those that came were descendants from the enemies of the Jews. Shemaiah v'Avtalion, the teachers of Hillel, they were the leaders of the Sanhedrin before Hillel, were descendants of Sancheriv. Sancheriv was the Assyrian king that laid waste to Judea, that almost captured Yerushalayim. Rabbi Akiva, which we're going to discuss in a future lecture, was a descendant of Sisera. This was the Canaanite general who fought against Devorah and Barak. Yuchus didn't seem to play a role in their success coming from a great family. So again, that doesn't seem to be a critical ingredient. What then is, let's say, the critical ingredient? And of course, although there are many factors that go into producing a great person, one factor, one ingredient that seems to play a very, very prominent role, if not the most important role, is the character trait of humility, of anova. When Moshe Rabbeinu, when Moses was described in the Torah, the greatest compliment that he was given was his onov mikol odom. He's the most humble of all people. There's a Gemara Nedorim in Lamed Ches Omer Aleph in 38a that says that it's a prerequisite for every prophet, every Novi, has to have that quality of humility. Otherwise, Hashem does not use that person as a vehicle to communicate to the Jewish people. Not only is it a prerequisite for prophecy, it's a prerequisite for Torah as well. There's a Gemara in Tainus, Zion Omed Aleph in 7a, that explains why the Torah is likened unto water. Just like water flows from a high slope down until it reaches sea level. It can't go any further. So too the Torah flows down until the lowliest and the lowest of receptacles, the most humble of people. That's why the Mount Sinai, where it says the Megillah and Chof Tes Omad Aleph in 29a, the Mount Sinai was chosen as the place from which the Torah was given. Because Mount Sinai is really a hill. It's not a real mountain. To teach us the lesson of humility. It had to be elevated in a sense just because of the dynamics of the giving of the Torah. But the area which was above the Jews, you know, so they could see the vision of the fire, the height was kept to a minimum to teach us the lesson of humility. And if that's the case, that if humility is such an important ingredient, perhaps more important than any other of the ingredients that we listed, it comes out a strange irony that the one who's the most blessed in all the other qualities, one who comes from a prestigious family, one comes from a situation of wealth, one where one is groomed from infancy to become a great person. Such a person has the greatest challenge to maintain his humility. It's a Gemara in Nedorim, in Pei Aleph Omad Aleph, in 81a. It says, Hizoro mibnei aniyim. Be careful, I'm telling the teachers, be careful with your students who are the children of the poor. Shemehem teitzei Torah. Because from them the Torah will come. And the Gemara quotes a posik that says that one draws water from the lowest area. As one puts the bucket down and draws up the water. That ironically, there's an advantage to be deficient. The Gemara continues on to describe a very interesting sociological phenomenon. That Talmidei Chachamim, at least in the time of the Talmud, the great scholars did not have children that were great scholars, or at least it did not happen in the frequency that one would normally expect. This is strange. Why is that so? And there are various theories offered. One of them is Mneshim is Gabrim Alatzipa, because these are scholars. They have a very prominent role, and they tend to dominate the community. And as a result, they don't merit to have children to be Talmidei Chacham, to be scholars. Evidently, that if one has that superior attitude, it's not one which is conducive to produce scholars. Rav Ashi suggests the fact Neshekorim b'nei Yodam, says the Amayorets, they call the unlearned chamorim. They call them donkeys. They look at people that are not learned as less than human. And that stance of arrogance is the reason why they are punished by not having children, Talmidei Chachamim, children to be scholars. It would seem that arrogance does not go hand in hand in producing a scholar. So one would think that if one comes from wealth, one comes from a family of scholarship, one would be a shoo-in, so to speak, to become a great scholar. Yet, it's not so. In fact, then, that if we find someone who has all the talents, in a certain sense, it's remarkable that this, we would say, despite all his talents, he grew up to be such a great person. many of those who have gone to yeshivas, analysis that there are in the course of years many iluyim, many prodigies that come through the doors of the yeshiva. People blessed kishroinus, blessed talents, and memory, and profundity, quickness of grasp, and yet very few of them grow up to be the great scholars, the great Talmidei Chacham, the great leaders of the generation. And is this paradox is really the subject of tonight's lecture. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, the subject of tonight's lecture, came from one of the most prestigious families of Jewry. He was the 10th generation of Ezra the scribe. Ezra was the leader of Jewry in the beginning of the period of the Second Temple. He was the greatest scholar. He was the subject of the lecture of one of the fifth lecture of our last series. And Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah was the 10th generation from Ezra. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah's father, Azariah, was one of the most prestigious people of Klal Yisrael. Not necessarily as a great scholar, but as a supporter of scholarship. In fact, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah's uncle, Shimon, was supported wholly by Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah's father. In fact, this Shimon, when he is quoted in the Talmud, is not quoted as Shimon the son of someone, but Shimon Achi Azariah. Shimon, the brother of Azariah, this was the brother that supported him. So Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah came from a family of one of the most esteemed families of Klal Yisrael, a descendant of Ezra's. He came from a family of wealth, a family that loved Torah. He himself inherited an immense abundance of property. The Gemara says in Shabbos, in Nun Dalet Amud Beis, in 54b, that Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah would give tithes every year from his herds of 12,000 calves. In other words, of the 120,000 calves that were born every year in his herd, he would give 12,000 as miser, as a tithe. That's a very large herd that produces 120,000 calves year in and year out. And that's only, we're speaking about his that which he owned in cattle. Who knows how much other kinds of property he had in different areas. And besides his wealth and his family, he was probably the greatest prodigy, at least that we have recorded, amongst the Tanoim, amongst the teachers of the Mishnah. At the age of 18, or some versions have at the age of 16, he was appointed to the highest office amongst the Jewish people. The leader, the Nasi, or the head of the Sanhedrin. Years before that, he sat in council, he sat together with the greatest of Jewry. Every year we say in the Haggadah of Pesach, Maisa, there was an incident of Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yeshua, Rabbi Tarfon, Rabbi Kiva, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. He sat for Blaz and Mishoy Mesuvim Bnei Brak. They were sitting all together, all five of them, six of them. These great scholars. And he is one of them. And as historians point out, since Rabbi Eliezer was there, after Rabbi Eliezer was put into Cherem, he was excommunicated, we're dealing with the years prior to his excommunication. The historians point out when Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah was appointed to be the head of the Sanhedrin, Rabbi Eliezer had already been put into cherem. He was already had been already excommunicated. So this was years before. How old could he have been then? 16, 15, 14. And he was an equal of the greatest amongst the Jewish people. So Rav Elozar ben Azariah, in one sense we could say, became the greatest scholar because of all his, that he was so gifted, all the blessings that were showered upon him. But in another sense, we could say, they became so great despite all the blessings that were given to him. We're going to begin now, I turn to page 2 in the notes, on that single incident that thrust him into the most prestigious position. This is an incident which we discussed in last lecture. I'm going to briefly deal with the beginnings of that incident again tonight. Rabban Gamliel, at this time, the story is going on, was then the Nasi. He was the head of the Sanhedrin. Rabban Gamliel received the office by virtue of the fact that his father was Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel, the one, the martyr that we discussed in the second lecture of our series. Even though he was one of the greats of the Jewish people, he wasn't, it seems, the greatest scholar. But Rabban Gamliel maintained that not so much because that he is the greatest scholar, but rather that the position that Rabban Gamliel occupies, that of the Nasi, the prince, the president of the Sanhedrin, is the greatest office, he therefore commands the greatest respect. There is a law, a halacha, that a student is not allowed to paskin, is not allowed to make a halachic ruling in near the area where the Rebbe, where the teacher resides. According to the Gemara, that's within 3 parsoyas. In other words, that's it would be like equivalent of some 6 miles. Of a 6 mile radius from wherever his Rebbe is, he is not allowed to issue any halachic rulings. Now, Rabbi Yehoshua was second to Rabban Gamliel. Rabbi Yehoshua was the Av Beis Din, according to the Gemara in Bava Kamma on Pei Dalet. He was called the father of the court. That was the position right below the Nasi, the president of the Sanhedrin. Rabbi Yehoshua, it seems, was not a student of Rabban Gamliel's. In fact, he was probably a greater scholar than Rabban Gamliel. But Rabban Gamliel had the greatest office. And there was an incident, and the question was in the status of the evening prayer, Ma'ariv. Does it have the same obligatory status of the other prayers, Shachris and Mincha, the morning prayer, the afternoon prayer, or does it have a less important status? Is it optional or relatively optional, or is it a real requirement? One has to daven the evening prayer, Ma'ariv, in the same manner as one davens the morning prayer and the afternoon prayer. That was the question that is discussed in the Gemara in Brachos. It's a really, today it's a moot point because of custom it has already become obligatory to pray Ma'ariv, to daven Ma'ariv. However, at that time the custom was not yet formed and was a real question, is it obligatory or is it compulsory? A student asked Rabbi Yehoshua the question, is it a chov, is it an obligation to daven Ma'ariv? Rabbi Yeshua's opinion was, It's optional. The same student, after he got the ruling from Rabbi Yeshua, went and asked Rabbi Gamliel. Rabbi Gamliel's opinion ran counter to Rabbi Yeshua's. Rabbi Gamliel says it's compulsory. Then the student blurted out, "But I just asked the same question to Rabbi Yeshua, and he says it's optional." With that, Rabbi Gamliel took offense, because Rabbi Gamliel felt that since Rabbi Gamliel was the Nasi, had the highest position, Rabbi Yeshua, who in terms of the hierarchy was below him, had no right to issue his own ruling. And Rabbi Gamliel took this issue to the full court, to the whole yeshiva. And he punished Rabbi Yeshua. He made him stand while Rabbi Gamliel made Rabbi Yeshua stand while he was giving the lecture. The colleagues of Rabbi Yeshua, Rabbi Akiva, other colleagues, took offense to what was happening to Rabbi Yeshua, and they felt that Rabbi Gamliel had no right to treat Rabbi Yeshua in such a manner, to treat him as an inferior, at least in such a manner. And they voted to depose Rabbi Gamliel. And the question was, who should they choose in Rabbi Gamliel's place? The most likely candidate would have been Rabbi Yeshua. But since Rabbi Yeshua was directly involved in this controversy, it was improper that Rabbi Yeshua should be the one who's appointed. Rashi explains that it would be too much hurt directly to Rabbi Gamliel. The Marsha explains that perhaps people would say, that the tongues would start wagging and say that, well, Rabbi Yeshua set this up in order for him to get the position. So as a result, Rabbi Yeshua's name was taken off those being the potential candidates. The next on the list was Rabbi Akiva. But the fear is Rabbi Akiva came from a family of converts. He didn't have his zechus avos. He didn't have the merit of generations of forefathers. And there was the fear that if Rabbi Gamliel would say some sort of a harsh word and curse Rabbi Akiva, and the idea of what a curse is to bring on Midas Hadin. What a curse is that a person, really one says that one should not have grace showered on the person, but rather the person should be judged on his own merit. Without any chesed, without any grace, without any rachamim, without any compassion, just simply a person should get what he deserves. And since it's very rare to find any perfect person, in tzaddik bor tzeshe yaseh tov lo yechta, there's no one who does everything totally good and doesn't make some minor mistake, there was the fear that if chas v'sholom, if God forbid, there would be a curse which would be uttered somehow, even if it would be by unintentionally, but it would be uttered from the lips of Rabbi Gamliel, Rabbi Akiva would not have the merits of his forefathers to stand by him as a protection. So Rabbi Akiva's name was taken off the list. The next candidate was Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. So you find on page 2, in the middle of the page, towards the bottom of the page, the last third. They said, "Let us appoint Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, who is wise." In other words, in terms of wisdom, in terms of his scholarship, he is really the most likely next candidate to have the position. "And rich, person of wealth. And 10th in descent from Ezra." It comes from a family which has sechus avos, that has the merit of the forefathers. "He is wise, so that if anyone puts a question to him, he'll be able to answer it." He is fitting to have that, fit for the position. "He is rich, so if the occasion arises for paying court to Caesar," and this is the question of bribing the higher authorities, "he'll be able to do so if the need arises. And he is 10th in descent from Ezra, so he has an ancestral merit, his husavos. The Roman Gamaliel cannot bring a curse upon him. They went and said to him, "Will your honor consent to be head of the yeshiva?" You think normally anyone would jump to the... It's a tremendous opportunity. It was an opportunity that was otherwise closed to him. Rabban Gamliel was the fifth generation from Hillel. It went from the time of Hillel, the position of Nasi went from father to son. In fact, as we're going to see, after Rabban Gamliel was reinstated, the next generation, the next one who got the position was Rabban Gamliel's son. And it went so from generation to generation to approximately the year 319 of the Common Era. As it started, Hillel got the position approximately the year 31 before the Common Era. And the last, the last one of the line, Hillel the second, at least we know the last year that the Sanhedrin functioned, perhaps it functioned even a little bit afterwards, was the year 319 when the calendar that we use today, was devised. That's well over 300 years. So here was the chance that a way to Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah that otherwise would have been closed to him. Normally you expect him to take the opportunity. His reply was, "I have to go and consult the members of my family. I have to consult my wife." And the reason, this is the commentaries explain, is that having now the position of the Nasi, the president of the Sanhedrin, the leader, takes with it tremendous responsibilities. It takes with him a tremendous demands on the time. How often do we find afterwards, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah traveling to Rome to intercede on behalf of Jewry? It's something that his wife has to be involved in the decision. He can't do it on his own. He can't do it for her sake. Her answer was, "You know, maybe they'll depose you later on." In other words, what about the hurt? In other words, now it feels great. You have this tremendous position and the opportunity. And what happens if these circumstances change? Maybe they'll reinstate Rabban Gamliel. Where will you be then? And she was concerned for his own feelings. Imagine going to, you know, if he's, as we're going to say, he was 18 years old. I mean, imagine the rest of his life just being a has-been, you know. You know, after, you know, a person goes his whole life, you know, the person is hoping, you know, he's at this level, he's going to go to the next level, and the next level. And you know, here, you got it, you lost it. Like, what left, you know, what else is there left in life to account? But it was the thing, you know, what's going to be? He replied, he wasn't concerned with that, with that problem. And he says, there was a common folk saying, to let a man use a cup of honor, and as a precious cup that's only used for aristocracy, for nobility, for one day, even if it'd be broken the next. It's worthwhile to have the experience now, even if it'll be taken away from me in the future. He wasn't concerned about his feelings. Then she brought up another objection. She said, "You have no white hair." I mean, after all, at least according to the version of the Talmud Bavli, he was only 18 years old. And a miracle occurred, and according to the version of the Talmud Bavli, he got 18 rows of white hair. He turned white. And it continues on, the Gemara, and says that this incident, as they had this incident that he was named at such, he was appointed at such an early age, and he turned white. This was part of the tradition. But the Gemara on its own now wants to based on this incident, wants to interpret a Mishnah that is one of the most widely known Mishnahs amongst Jewry. This is a Mishnah that's quoted also every Passover night by the Seder. It says, Harei ani keven shivim shanim. It says, I am, Rav Elazar ben Azariah said, I am like 70 years old. The Gemara explains, I am like 70 years old. I am not 70 years old. I'm in fact very young. It's only 18. However, it says, the statement was, but evidently I was, evidently seems through the miracle, evidently Hashem wanted me to have a position that was fit for a 70-year-old man. And as he says, and I was not, I didn't merit, I wasn't able to convince my colleagues, even though they saw that evidently I was a person that had to be reckoned with, I still wasn't able to convince my colleagues that the Exodus, Yetzias Mitzrayim, should be mentioned at night. I mean, this is the Mishnah we mention, you know, by the Seder every year. And it says he doesn't say 70 years old, but I am about 70 years old. About means the equivalent, but not really 70. The Talmud Yerushalmi, even though it also quotes, as we're going to see soon, a similar story with Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, and in the Yerushalmi's version, he's even younger, he's not 18, but 16, has a different interpretation, though, in that Mishnah about that I am about 70 years old. The Yerushalmi maintains the Mishnah means literally I am around 70, meaning 69, 68, I am an old man. This Mishnah was written some 50 years, describes an event that happened some 50 years after he was appointed. This was some over 50 years after he already was a Rosh Yeshiva for 50 years. And it points out, and isn't that amazing? Here he's 70 years old. He has this position for so long. And he lasted. This is quite rare. The Gemara makes a comment about Rabbonis Mekaberis Baleha, that positions of power bury those who own that position. Those in power tend to live short lives. Yet Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah was zoichi, he merited to live a very long life. Because even though he was appointed at such a young age and he functioned for such a long time, he still was, you see, 70 years in that position. It's amazing. This is the Yerushalmi. One could perhaps attribute why he was zoich, he merited such a long life, to a Gemara in Tumid. There's a Gemara in Tumid in Lamed Beis Amud Aleph in 32a that describes an incident with Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great visited Yerushalayim and spoke to the Zikne Dorum, to the elders of the south, the elders of Yerushalayim, and they debated different philosophical points. And Alexander asked them, says, what should a person do to live, to have a long life, to enjoy life? Ma yasodem v'yichya, what should he do to live? And their reply is yamasatzma, literally means kill himself. The commentator on Tumid explains that he should make himself like play dead. In other words, he should be a very humble person. Because if you're humble, everyone likes you. You're not a threat to anyone. And you live a very nice, pleasant life. Mayas Odom, Alexander continued, what should a person do? Viyamus? What should a person do? What are the things that a person does that will shorten one's life? How does one live a short life? And the scholar's reply was, Yechayas Atzmo, he should make himself alive. And according to the commentary, he should become arrogant. Start dominating people. Because no one likes someone who's arrogant. So there's all kinds of strife, and there's all kinds of aggravation and frustration. And this is his eye in horror, this is the evil eye. In other words, the people look askance at him. And it guarantees a short life. The problem would seem of Rabbonus Mekaberis is by Leho that power buries its owners is because they create too many enemies. They create too much jealousy. It's too much aggravation and frustration. It would seem, based on the Gemara and Talmud, that the key to the longevity of Elazar ben Azariah was the fact that he was a humble person. It was this quality that we mentioned in the beginning of this lecture. And that's why it was so remarkable that despite all that he had, he was able to maintain this tremendous humility. Eventually, the Gemara goes on to explain that Rabban Gamliel was reinstated. And if you look on page 4, in the middle of the first paragraph, after they decided to reinstate Rabban Gamliel and Rabbi Yeshua and Rabban Gamliel had come to terms. Yes, what should we do with Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah? Should we depose him? Well, we have a rule that we raise an object to a higher level of sanctity, Milam B'Kodesh, but must not degrade it to a lower level, Vein Moridin. You can't, once he was the Rosh Yeshiva, once he became the Nasi, we can't just lower him like that. If we let one of the privileges of being the Nasi was that they darshan, that they delivered a lecture every Shabbos. And up until then, Rabban Gamliel was delivering the weekly lecture. If we let one master preach on one Shabbos and one on the next, this will cause jealousy. Then Rabban Gamliel will feel terrible. Here we have this 18-year-old, and is old enough probably to be his grandson, who is the equal of his. Let therefore Rabban Gamliel preach three Shabbosim and Rabban Elazar ben Azariah one Shabbos. Right. And that really was, throughout the lifetime of Rabban Gamliel, that was the arrangement. That they shared the position, but Rabban Gamliel had the greatest of the two. He was the first amongst equals. The Yerushalmi has a quote, a very similar story. The difference in the two stories being that in the Yerushalmi's version, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah is only 16 years old. If you see on page 5 in the second paragraph, this is from the Yerushalmi and Brachas, Rabbi Akiva was sitting in pain. He felt bad. Rabbi Akiva normally would have been the most likely, as after Rabbi Yeshua, Rabbi Akiva would have been the one who would have been appointed. And he was overlooked because of the lack of family. Rabbi Akiva says, not that he's a greater Torah scholar than I, but rather he is much more a descendant of great men than I. Fortune is the person that has a peg to hang on. What was the peg of Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah? He was the 10th generation from Ezra. How did Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah grow in such a short period of time to such a level? I mean, true, he had tremendous Kishroinus. He had tremendous talent, tremendous genius. But who did he learn Torah from? He must have someone who imparted to him, even though he had this tremendous memory and grasp and depth. But he had to have learned the Torah from some living person, some great person, who would be able to impart to him all this knowledge. Seems that person was Rabbi Yossi HaGalili. Rabbi Yossi HaGalili, even though he will not be covered in length in this series, was also a contemporary of Rabbi Akiva, of Rabbi Tarfon, one of the greats of the generation. And it seemed that Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah's youth was spent in the Galilee. Now the Galilee, the Golu, was outside, say, the main area of Jewish scholarship. The main area was in the lower part of the country, the south. Yavne, where the yeshiva was near the coast in the south of Israel. This was in the area that was once that was in the Phoenician coast. This was in biblical times it was controlled by the Philistines. In later times it really was not really a main Jewish center, but it was in the south part of Israel. The Galilee is in the north. So Rabbi Yossi HaGalili, even though he was a contemporary of Rabbi Akiva's, he only went down to the south, it would seem, after his student Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah had risen to the highest position. And here on page 7, we have a fascinating story. I want to quote, which brings together the lives of Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah and his mentor, Rabbi Yossi HaGalili. This is Rabbi Yossi, this is based on the Yerushalmi. This is the stories we quote as the Medrash Rabbah. This is in Bereishis, it's Perek, it's in chapter 17. Rabbi Yossi HaGalili had a terrible wife, we're going to see. Originally he had married her. She was the daughter of his sister. And it was common, the Gemara describes, it was common that one would marry the daughter of one's sister. The fact is, it's part of the family. There's the felt that there would be a greater attraction between the two, and there would be a greater common bond. But she would disgrace him in front of his disciples, to the extent that his disciples, his Talmidim, advised him to divorce her. And he himself would be ready to divorce her. The relationship was so painful for him. But in the original, in the ksuba, in the marriage contract, there was provisions for an alimony payment. At the time, if it would end in divorce, and the amount was such that it was beyond his means. So he just couldn't divorce her because he could never pay the alimony payment. Once, when Rabbi Yossi HaGalili and Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah had finished learning together, Rabbi Yossi told Rabbi Elazar, come to my house, we'll eat something. I'll invite you for a meal. Elazar ben Azariah consented. When they entered the house, Rabbi Yossi's wife didn't look at him. She turned her face away in anger, looking downward, and left the room. Rabbi Yossi looked at a pot that was on the stove, and he asked his wife, but he didn't get there yet. And as he was going, he says, is there anything in the pot? He says, yes, she said, there's parpurine. It was a kind of an appetizer. That's the answer she gave. She had left the room. She was in the other room. She says, there's the parpurine. He went and looked up, and she had lied, and there was some chicken. Rabbi Elazar realized what he had heard. In other words, that his wife had, the relations were just so soured. And as they sat down to eat, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah asked him, says, Rebbe, says, you said we're going to have parpurin. Look, says, we have chicken. How did that happen? So he says, a miracle. Well, as they were finishing, Rabbi Elazar told him, listen, you can't live life like this. You should divorce her. She doesn't treat you with respect. So his reply was, the alimony payment's too great. I can't pay it. He says, we'll give you the money. Rebbe says, don't worry. I'll come up with the sum. He says, I can't see you living like this. And he followed Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah's advice, and he divorced her, and he gave her the alimony payment based on the money Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah was able to present to his Rebbe. Eventually, Rabbi Yossi HaGalili built a new life for himself. He married a much better wife. His old wife also remarried, but she married a policeman of the city. A policeman generally, because of their position, the fact is that they were very often they had connections to the Roman government, were people who were in status in terms of their piety and scholarship were in the lowest rungs of Jewish society in that particular instance. Not necessarily in a time when there was a Jewish state, when there were shoterim, and those were the court-appointed marshals of the court. It's quite likely these people were Talmid Chachomim, were people of scholarship and piety. But here, this was a foreign government. This was a Jewish policeman appointed by the Romans. Be the parallel of the Jewish policemen that were appointed by the Nazis in the ghettos. And this was the kind of person that she married. Probably, though, the policeman had a certain power, or able in terms of bribes, had a certain wealth. But after a while, he lost his job as a policeman. He developed a sickness, he was in great pain, and eventually became blind. And he was forced to being a beggar. And she would hold him by the hand and take him around the marketplaces of the city. And actually now she would force him, the wife would take this husband, and he would beg from place to place. But when she went by the street of Rabbi Yossi HaGalili, she would stop, she'd get in there and turn around, and she didn't let her husband. Now, her husband was a policeman, so he knew. Even though he was blind, but he had a feel of the city. And he asked her, says, why didn't you take me to the neighborhood of Rabbi Yossi HaGalili? I've heard he does good deeds and is a charitable person. I'll go to him and we'll get a nice nadal. It could be when in the second marriage, afterwards his fortune changed as well and he was doing well. So she replied, listen, I'm his divorcee. You know that. I don't want to be beneficiary of his goodwill. I can't. The shame is too much. How can I go ask him? One time, they happened to be coming again. They came as they were going on their rounds. They came near Rabbi Yossi HaGalili's neighborhood, and again he felt that he wanted to collect here. And she didn't want to go there because of her embarrassment. And he started becoming physically abusive. He started yelling at her, hitting her. And it became the whole commotion. Rabbi Yossi himself heard those screams and went out and saw what was happening. And he went out to this former policeman. He says, why are you hitting her? He replied, listen, every day she's making me lose the income I would have gained from this area. So Rabbi Yossi heard this, he took them and placed them in one of the houses that he owned and supported them as long as they lived. As is written, Sorchal to Salem, hide not from your own flesh, it was his niece. And he supported them as long as, it's an amazing story. Here's a person who gave him tzoros, gave him terrible pain while they were married. She married someone. The fact that she remarried such a person was a slap in his face. And when she fell on hard times, he took her in and supported her for the rest of her life. It's an amazing story. This was the teacher of Rabbullah. This is the mentor of Rabbullah ben Azariah. So you have a sense of what kind, what was planted in him, that he grew to be the person that he became. I would like to go over with you, let's say, the legacy of Rabbullah ben Azariah, the teachings that he's left us with. On page 9, we have a quote from Avos, Pirkei Avos, in chapter 3. Rabbullah ben Azariah said, the Hebrews, Imein Torah ein derech eretz. If there's no Torah, there's no worldly occupation. This is according to Rashi's interpretation of this. But if there's no worldly occupation, there's no Torah. Evidently, one could not, it's not clear into what sense this means, but if one is not dedicated to a life of Torah, one can't necessarily expect the blessing showered upon him, in the sense that Hashem should take interest in his life. There's a Gemara in Brochas, Lamed Hei Amud Beis, in 35b, that this is the time of, this is Rabbi Yochanan is quoting Rabbi Yehuda Bar Eloi. Rabbi Yehuda Bar Eloi is the was a one of the great students of Rabbi Akiva, and he was bemoaning the change in generations. He says, previous generations used to make their Torah the Iker. Learning Torah was the most important, the Torah and Keva, the most important part of their life. And their work, their career was haphazard, was secondary. And both of them, they had, those people had success in both areas. They were successful in the Torah they learned, they were successful in their livelihood. Doris Achroinim, the latter generations, Malachton Keva, their work is set, as their work is the most important part of their life. Teros on Aroy, their learning is secondary. Vizu, and both of them are not successful. There is the sense that the if one devotes his life to Torah, there's a special providence that shines, a special blessings that are shined upon him. So if there's no Torah, there's no worldly occupation. However, if there's no worldly occupation, if one, according to this explanation, one just studies Torah expecting some sort of a miracle to occur, says, there's no Torah. If you don't have some sort of a livelihood, how can one continue on learning? One will just learn, and then when there's no money, what is he supposed to do? So the one has to have, Rabbullah ben Azariah argued, there has to be a balance. There has to be the Torah, has to be the study of the Torah, there has to be the worldly occupation. They have to be balanced. If you have one, you won't have the other. I mean, you need both simultaneously. If you just totally put yourself into work without studying Torah, you won't have the blessings of Hashem to give you hatzlocha, success in that work. On the other hand, if you totally devote yourself to Torah, you just won't have you can't continue on. So there has to be the balance of both. This is how Rashi interprets this passage. Rabbeinu Yonah, one of the great commentaries of us, has a different explanation. And he translates Derech Eretz, You mean Torah and Derech Eretz? There's no Torah, there's no Derech Eretz. The way of the land, referring to midos, to etiquette, to manners, to character perfection. He says, if a person is not made of higher stuff, if one doesn't have a refined character, there's no Torah. One can't learn Torah. One can't develop. One has to have in concert with one's learning, one has to have a sense of a higher of a refinement, of a higher calling. On the other hand, imein Torah, but if one has no study of Torah, ein derech eretz, then one cannot truly refine his character. One doesn't know what to do, what true values are, what priorities to set. So one needs them both. One has to put attention on one's character and refining one's character. At the same time, one has to immerse oneself in learning. You need both. That's Rabbeinu Yonah's explanation. And continues on, if there's no wisdom, there's no fear of God. If there's no fear of God, there's no wisdom. Again, this is the idea of the balance. If one is not a Talmud Chacham, if one isn't an intellect, if one doesn't see God in the Torah, one doesn't see God in nature, one can never develop a fear of God. On the other hand, if one doesn't have some minimal fear of God, some awareness of God's presence, when one learns, the learning itself will not provide it. One has to look for God, and one will find God. So one needs, again, both. One has to have the fear of God, has to have this divine sense. One has to study Torah, has to go hand in hand. One feeds on the other. Imein das ein bina. And we've translated this, if there's no knowledge, there's no understanding. If there's no understanding, there's no knowledge. We use the common English translation. The word bina, from the commentators, is defined as not just merely understanding, but mevin dover mitoich dover. One understands one thing from another thing. And as one analyzes, would be the makeup of a certain idea, and then can apply it, one once understands it, to something else. And bina, therefore, is related to the word bone, which means to build. One can make a tsushta, one can make a comparison. If one knows the features of this, analyze the features of A, one now can make a comparison to B. Das is the quality, at least according to one definition, of the, what we called the gestalt, the whole picture. Is where all the pieces of the puzzle are put together. If one does not have a sense of a gestalt, in other words, of idea, I want to know the wholeness, the hope, then one doesn't know where one is going. And it says, Emein das, ein bina. If one doesn't have a sense of that there's an order and that there's a system, and you're looking for a system, then you won't take one thing and try to compare it to something else. But if you don't, so you need to have a sense that there is a system before now you make the analysis, and now you say, hey, he says, this will fit in here, this will fit in there. So you have to have a pre-sense that there is such a system. This is the das. Before you have bina. But if you're not going to exercise that bina, that understanding, and trying to analyze a certain idea, and then compare it, hey, in this situation, you know, if it works here, then it'll work over there, and it'll work over here. If you don't actually use your bina, you're never going to achieve the full system. So there has to be a sense that there is a system, and then you work towards it. So ein das, ein bina. So if you don't have a system, or at least the beginnings of a system, you can't have any understanding. You can't apply it. But if ein bina, ein das, if you don't apply it, you'll never get the system. It would be like, in a certain sense, when Newton discovered the laws of physics. He had a sense that there must be a system, and something which is predictable, and there's certain patterns that will, and there's certain patterns that are repetitive, and there are certain principles that govern these patterns. So he had the das, in a sense, the pre-das, before he had the bina. Now the bina would be, if one makes an experiment and sees that there's certain acceleration, that in this situation, hey, that what will be in the next situation? Well, if it's going at this, if the velocity is such and the acceleration is such, that I will predict in the following situation will be this and this. And he experimented. And therefore he found, he had the sense to make the comparison, and he developed the system. If there's no imen kemach, ein Torah ein kemach. If there's no flower, there's no Torah. If there's no Torah, there's no flower. If I defined the first statement of Derech Eretz, I mean Torah and Derech Eretz, or Derech Eretz, as character perfection, then I will simply translate this word flower means simply flower. There's no bread to eat, you can't learn Torah. So if I translated the first, as it's on the sheets, if there's no Torah, there's no worldly occupation, and I translated the Derech Eretz to mean a livelihood, therefore the idea of flower here has a different explanation. And the idea of flower is, when one studies on two different levels. One studies, let's say, Bikias, one develops a breadth of knowledge, a broad accumulation of knowledge in various fields, and then there is the grinding. You take the idea and you grind into little pieces to analyze every part of it. The flower is the analysis. The Torah is this vast information. Well, if you don't have any information, there's not much to grind. If you don't grind, you won't appreciate all that you have. You need both. And the yeshivas, they generally have, known as a Bikia Seder, and as they have a part of it, it's devoted to develop knowledge, even without one does not really fathom the profundity of the knowledge. And then there's an Eon Seder. There's a part of the day which is devoted to understanding. This is the two. And this is the balance that he spoke of. He used to say, anyone whose wisdom exceeds his good deeds, and he goes on, is what is he likened to a tree whose branches are numerous but whose roots are few. He speaks of the idea of one has more wisdom than good deeds. And that refers to someone who does not practice, in a sense, what he preaches. He knows more than he actually does. He does not implement all his knowledge. It's a very weak foundation. When the pressures of life are set upon him, when the winds blow, it's uprooted. He knows it all, but it's cerebral. It's just in his mind. He hasn't integrated into his whole psyche, into his whole life. But he continues on, he goes on to explain though a person whose deeds exceed his wisdom is like a person, is like this tree that has few branches but has many roots. It isn't top heavy. It's firmly planted. All the winds of the world were to come, it won't move, it won't budge, this tree. And he speaks of an idea of having more deeds than wisdom. And Rabbeinu Yonah, the great commentator on Ovos, asked the question, says, how is it possible to have more deeds than knowledge? You could say that I act in concert with my knowledge, to the level of my knowledge. But how can you do more than you know? You could do as much as you know, but how can you do more than you know? I mean, if you're doing it, you know how to do it. So evidently you know it. So how can you be doing more than you know? So Rabbeinu Yonah explains this is dealing with not what actually what you've done, but what you've committed yourself to do. This is the Nas of Anishma. And really, a novice Reb Nosson brings the Pusik, quotes the verse, that the Jews, before receiving the Torah on Mount Sinai, said, Nasa we will do, Nishma we will listen. We are ready to do whatever you tell us, we're ready to do. So we are ready to do. Now we will listen. But the listening, the commitment, came before the knowledge. So one actually hasn't done it, but one is prepared to do it. And that means one's good deeds, we're counting those deeds that one has committed oneself to do, even though it hasn't been done yet. So one, you know, it's the idea that I am determined to fulfill the Torah. I don't know exactly what I'm required to do. Give me the instructions, I'll do them. But I'm here. It's Nasa V'Nishma. It's that attitude that will ensure that's when the roots are firmly planted. So this statement of Vavas is one legacy that he left us. I quote here on page 10, and time doesn't allow to the entire, I'm just going to bring one of these. There are three separate memories of his, three separate statements of his. But I'll just bring, I'll explain the first one, you can look through the notes yourself. There were students of Reb Elozer ben Azarias of the yeshiva, this is in the end of page 9, Yochanan ben Broicher, Reb Elozer ben Chisma, who went to visit Rabbi Yeshua. And Rabbi Yeshua asked them, he says, you know, you're Shabbos in the yeshiva, you know, who darshan that Shabbos? Shabbos shall meet. And this was Rabbi Rami Gamliel Shabbos, Reb Elozer ben Azarias Shabbos, and they took turns. So they said it was Reb Elozer ben Azarias Shabbos. He says, what did he say? They originally were reluctant. They didn't want to tell Rabbi Yeshua anything. They really came to tell Rabbi Yeshua. He says, you know, we came to listen to you. I mean, you don't need us. We came Rebbe. We came, you know, these are the Talmidim, the students. They came to Rabbi Yeshua. He was older already. He no longer participated in the yeshiva. But he said, you know, listen, we came to hear from you. He says, no, I want to hear what did you bring me? What did Rosa ben Azariah say? So they says what he said. He says, there's a mitzvah of hakel. There's a mitzvah that once in 7 years, all of Jewry is gathered together, and the king, the leader of the Jewish people, goes and reads the Torah to them. And there's important sections of the Torah that are read to them. And the mitzvah is that men, women, and little children come to listen to the Torah. So Reb Elozer ben Azariah asked, men and women, they're adults, you understand, they're coming to learn, to be inspired. But what are the little kids coming for? They don't have a requirement to learn. They're too little to learn. They're even infants. There's a child would be nursery age, kindergarten, early grades perhaps, if he knows the Hebrew language, can pick up something. What could a little infant pick up? What's the mitzvah to bring little infants? And his answer, Elizabeth Nazari, was to grant reward to those that bring them. That answer is really a puzzling answer. Is really the subject of much discussion amongst the commentators. The question was, what's the purpose of bringing them? And the answer was to give reward to those who bring them. It's not much of an answer to the question. You know, if the answer was the children will gain by the experience, you know, just like Rabbi Yeshua's mother brought Rabbi Yeshua as an infant, brought the crib to the place where the learning occurred so the child should absorb the sounds of learning, that would be an answer. But all the answer is merely to give reward to those who bring the children. How is that really an answer? So I heard an explanation from various, this is in the Ksav Sofer, this is the son of the Chasam Sofer. And he explains, you know, there are many things in life we have to do. They're not particularly mitzvahs, we just have to do it. He says, if every adult, everyone above bar mitzvah is required to come, who's going to take care of the kids? You know, you have to bring the kids. You know, even if they would offer babysitting service, but you have the kids babysitting for the kids. I mean, they have to go and bring the kids. All Jewry is going from top to bottom, from the north of Israel to the south of Israel. They're all converging in Yerushalayim. They have to come as a family. They have to bring their children. So they have to come anyway. But the difference would be that they are coming. There's no mitzvah involved. It's a schlep, you know. What can you do? You have to come and you just have to bring the kids. What the Torah did is it ennobled an act that had to have been done anyway and made it from something which was just a drudgery and made it into a mitzvah. You have to bring the kids in any case. But now what the Torah said is this bringing I'm sanctifying, it becomes a mitzvah. And that's the idea was that Hashem created as a mitzvah to give reward to those that do it. They're going to do it anyway. They won't receive any reward. There's no ennobling act. It's something which is begrudgingly done. Now this became a commandment. One is fulfilling God's will by doing so. This is really what the Torah did was ennobled an act that had to have been done and brought it and raised its whole level. The whole motivation has changed. It now became something which just must be done, that I'm fulfilling Hashem's will in doing so. And Rabbi Yeshua's reply was to them, said, there was such a beautiful jewel in your hand and you sought to deprive me of it. You didn't want to tell me this for it, because I had to drag it out of you. He says, I'm so happy that I forced you to tell me this. On page 11, you find this very famous statement. Two more of his sayings, the famous sayings, but he's the author of them. Rav Shizbi said in the name of Rav Elazar ben Azariah, Koshem is anoisiv shel odam kakriyas yamsuf. Making a living is as difficult as splitting the Red Sea. This is his. As one shouldn't take for granted, you know, that you know, things have been going well, will still be going well, and making a living is a miracle. And it's a it's no less a miracle, and God's involved in it. Don't forget for one moment. Don't think because you call it luck or your brains or whatever it is. It's Hashem, just like that, the splitting of the Red Sea. And it's difficult. You need schusim, you need merit, you need prayer. The second statement we have here, this is in paragraph D. Rish Lakish said, "Name Reb Elazar ben Azariah, a person should be careful not to favor one child over another. Because of the special coat, the Ksoinis Pasim, that our father Yaakov, the patriarch Yaakov, made for Yosef, the result was, we read, says they hated him. Must be very careful in the family to preserve the shalom in the family, the harmony in the family. Kids pick up if you favor one child over another. It's very important that you treat them all equally." And when he died, Reb Elazar ben Azariah, and it seems from the Yerushalmi, this is after a long life of being a Rosh Yeshiva, they says the crown of wisdom ceased. Says Itrois Chochma, because the crown, Ateres Chachomim Oshram, the crown of the wise, is their riches. Very often, people don't appreciate a Talmud Chacham, a scholar, when all they see is just his scholarship. They don't see anything. And that's why it's an enhancement for the effect that a Talmud Chacham, the scholar, has over the community at large. It's an enhancement that if he is blessed with wealth. Because people in their minds consider, you know, he's wealthy, he's successful, maybe there's something to him, I can't dismiss him. It's for that reason, the Gemara says in the Dorman Lamed Chesam Ad Aleph, in 38a, that the prophets were wealthy. Prophets is spelled, this is P-R-O. The prophets, the Nevi'im, were men of wealth to make an impact on the community. There's one theory, there's a Gemara in Shabbos and Kuf Mem Hei Amud Beis, 145b, that that why the scholars in Bavel, in Babylon, wore prestigious clothing was that the populace would see their clothing and therefore give them respect. They wouldn't normally appreciate them if they saw them. They'd have the clothing would be similar to the populace. That's where they needed special clothing. They felt that when Elazar ben Azariah died, that something died with him. That crown, the respect, the splendor that comes with the scholar who has wealth, that period has come to an end. This ends the lecture of Elazar ben Azariah. In 2 weeks, we will study a remarkable person, the life of Rabbi Tarfon. Are there any questions? Yeah.
If I understand correctly, what the hint is where Elazar ben Azariah was appointed, Rabbi Elazar, happened.
It's because they both deal. The question was why is it in the Haggadah we have the one story of Reb Elazar ben Azariah sitting together with Reb Eliezer? Evidently, he was very, very young, because he was appointed to be the head of the yeshiva after Reb Eliezer was put in Cherem, was excommunicated. If he was sitting with him, it was years, it was some time before. If he was appointed when he was 18 or 16, so some years before, according to the Yerushalmi, the statement, Hare ani kaven shivim shana, I am 70, is literally, I am 70 years old. In other words, or 69 or 68. This is speaking about that he was saying that here I am 70 years old, I've been a Rosh Yeshiva for 50 years, and I'm still not able to convince my colleagues. Such a gap, a chronological gap. But the truth is that really they were put to the juxtaposition between the two statements in the Haggadah is not because the chronology fits, is because they both deal with different aspects of the commemoration of the Exodus. That's why it's there. It would seem that he took over the there's really no mention, but Rabban Gamliel's son, Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel, became the Nosi, became the head many, many years after the death of Rabban Gamliel. That seems just, historians place it, there was a very large gap. And there's no other mention of anyone in a similar position. One would assume that Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, after the death of Rabbi Gamliel, had the sole position then. Yes? Right. There's a mention, there's a Gemara in Shabbos, about the ribbon of Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah's cow, and the question of a ribbon on a cow to be considered caring. And just as one is supposed to rest on Shabbos, one has to rest one's animals on Shabbos. And that was the question of the ribbon being caring. The Gemara comments on this and asks the question, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah only had one cow? If he gave tithes of 12,000 calves every year, he had many, many cows. And the more answers, really, it was a neighbor's cow. It wasn't really his cow. They only called it his cow euphemistically because he saw his neighbor's cow going with a red ribbon. He didn't say anything. And he should have rebuked his neighbor. And because Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah did not give teichacha, didn't give rebuke to the neighbor, it is considered as if it was his own cow that went out. I mean, that's why it's there. And that's why they only mention it, because of that incident. And the Gemara goes on to explain the idea of communal responsibility and that every Jew is responsible for his fellow Jew. So that's why it's there.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237.